Hello, it's Tuesday, April the 13th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, the BMI, or Body Mass Index. I'm rather proud of mine, but actually, a committee of MPs saying it's out of date and being overused to determine whether we're obese or underweight. They're open again. Pubs reopening. Drinkers and diners, much happier. But they've all got to use this NHS app. Are we walking into, or sleepwalking into, a privacy nightmare? Prince William and Harry have issued their own heartfelt tributes to their grandfather. We'll be talking to Richard Kay, our editor-at-large, about that. But first, Boris Johnson has ordered a thorough investigation into David Cameron's paid lobbying of ministers for that financial firm, Greensill Capital. I'm going to be talking to Sir Anthony Seldon, who wrote Cameron at 10, about why he thinks David Cameron has behaved inappropriately. The Prime Minister has ordered what he describes as a thorough investigation into David Cameron's paid lobbying of ministers for the controversial finance firm Greensill, which has collapsed, threatening potentially thousands of jobs. Sir Anthony Seldon, the historian who wrote Cameron at 10, says the review will be humiliation piled upon humiliation, coming from the man, Boris Johnson, who was responsible for Cameron's departure from 10 Downing Street after that referendum in 2016. I'm delighted to say Sir Anthony joins me now. Sir Anthony, this story has been rumbling on for a very long time. We know that after the Prime Minister left Number 10, after the allotted period of 2 years when he's allowed to take paid lobbying jobs, he was hired to lobby for Greensill Capital. Greensill Capital, run by a man called Lex Greensill, who had been given a desk in the Cabinet Office when the Prime Minister, when David Cameron was Prime Minister. How much trouble is he in now the Prime Minister has ordered this review of his activities?
Well, it does depend clearly what the review says, but he's in a pickle and he has behaved unwisely, because even if he is able to satisfy every single question, his conduct has brought himself and the office of Prime Minister into question, and it's corrosive of trust. And somebody who has been Prime Minister has a duty to uphold honesty and the values that they espouse when they're in office. And of course, there's nothing wrong with making money. I mean, you don't make much money as Prime Minister. You make less money than many head teachers of secondary schools. Absolutely fine to make money, but you should conduct yourself in a way that is seen to be totally beyond reproach.
And we know what we know. Greensill Capital got into financial difficulties, and David Cameron pressured the government to make available potential government loans. And he did that by texting Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, on his personal number, contacting other ministers, contacting a political advisor at Number 10, and even involving the Secretary of State for Health, Matt Hancock, in having a drink with him and Lex Greensill, who'd been developing a way of financing health work. Does that pass the smell test for Sir Anthony Seldon?
Well, clearly it doesn't, Andrew, and he should have known that. He should have been more prudent and more cautious, not dragged other people still in government into embarrassing positions. You know, anybody's held great office should use their common sense more and their nous more. He can't say that he's behaved impeccably when there is so much and so widespread concern and doubt about his actions. You have to be not just beyond reproach, but to be seen to be on reproach. And I don't think David Cameron is a bad person. I think his premiership, he did many good things in it. He's extraordinarily clever. I think he does want the best. I think he probably thought he was doing the best in his actions, but he clearly was naive and didn't think properly and was ill-advised, unwise, imprudent. And I think that's a shame, for great shame for everybody. We shouldn't be talking about this now. What good has come out of this?
The problem as well for David Cameron is this, isn't it, Sir Anthony, that I think it's perfectly in order for a former Prime Minister concerned that a company may be going under, threatening thousands of jobs, because we know Greensill Capital has been involved in funding the British steel industry. But the fact he was on the books of Greensill, he was a paid lobbyist, he stood to make tens of millions of pounds in share options in Greensill Capital. So one wonders, was he motivated when he texted the Chancellor of the Exchequer and those other government ministers by a genuine concern that jobs would be affected? Or was another factor, or was it the main factor, the fact he could see a bumper payout, probably the biggest any former Prime Minister this country's ever had, tens of millions of pounds? Some people think he could have made £45 million. Was he motivated by that more?
Well, I mean, you'll be unsurprised to hear me say, I don't know. But what I do know is he should never have put himself in that position where these questions would be asked. What was he thinking of? He could have found other ways. He's very bright, very capable. He could have found perfectly legit ways, as other former prime ministers have found, and other former ministers, to make whatever money he needed without raising these questions. And so, you know, he's been unwise, Andrew. It's hard for former prime ministers. They used to, 40, 50 years ago, go back into politics, remain as backbenchers. Some went on to become, like Alec Douglas Hume, foreign secretary. Sometimes they returned as prime minister. He made it clear he didn't want to do that. He's left politics. He should have mapped it out far more clearly and prudently, so he could have been beyond and above suspicion, which he has not done. So I think it's very difficult. Look, to be a former prime minister, it's hard enough to be prime minister and to make a success of the job. It's even harder afterwards. Nothing wrong with trying to think about your family and your looking after yourself after so long that he spent in politics, but he went about it the wrong way. And he can still recover his reputation. Some prime ministers, John Major, for example, has become something of a national treasure. That's not beyond what David Cameron is possible for him, but he has to absolutely acknowledge that even if he's cleared on technicalities, that he's been imprudent, and he needs to wise up in future and not create this angst, not least for people who wish him well, who are just so bemused and perplexed by what he's done.
Just finally, Gordon Brown intervened, the former Prime Minister. Most of the money he's raised since he left Number 10, he's given to charity. He said former Prime Ministers should not be paid lobbyists. He said there are other ways they can make their money. I think he's got a point, hasn't he?
Well, I do, Andrew. Yeah, I do, you know, it's always going to be shady lobbying. You've got to do it behind closed doors. You can't publicly let everybody know what you're lobbying, because all the time it just doesn't work. And therefore, by the very nature of the art, it's going to invite questions about what was said and to who and to what extent were you exerting leverage because of specialist knowledge and special and insider contacts. It's a murky world. And Gordon Brown, who himself has been, as has Theresa May, conducted themselves extraordinarily well, in as far as we can judge. He is absolutely right. And so I think that David Cameron has to have a deep rethink. And the public is forgiving if somebody genuinely shows contrition, and then sets out a new course for their life, he can get back on tracks, but only if he acknowledges that this really was a significant error of judgment.
That's Sir Anthony Seldon, the historian who is the author of Cameron at 10. If you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, why don't you subscribe to us? Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. And if you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPearce. Prince William and Prince Harry have issued their own separate heartfelt tributes to their much-loved grandfather. In today's Daily Mail, our peerless editor-at-large, Richard Kay, writes how William's offering was formal and sober. Harry's captured some of Prince Philip's irreverence, but the fact that the prince has issued separate statements, as they might once have issued a joint one, is very telling. Richard Kay joins me now. Richard, would they a few years ago, before the much publicised rift, have issued a joint statement or not, do you think?
Oh, I think they most definitely would. And in many ways, this was a great opportunity. Here was a chance to put this rift, and there is a rift between them, to bed, if you like, in a way, by showing that they'd come together because of their grandfather's death. I mean, it does feel like a missed opportunity. On the other hand, of course, they're both adults. They're entitled to put out their own statements in their own way. I mean, they were definitely both very different in their tone.
Yeah, and some people have drawn a lot of significance in the words. William saying he and Catherine were there to serve the Queen as Prince Philip would have wanted, which you can then contrast that with Prince Harry, who's not going to serve the Queen.
I think that's a crucial point. I mean, whether it was pointed, whether it was a barb, deliberate or otherwise, we don't really know. But William was making clear that he sees his role as one of service and support for the monarchy. Harry has chosen to break away from the royal family. He lives in exile now. He can no longer represent his family in the way that he once did. And so he could not use those same kind of words.
We won't know, of course, because it's all behind the scenes, but very difficult for Prince Harry to have face-to-face meetings with his brother or the Queen because he's got to isolate for some time because he's just flown in from America. They might talk on the phone. How long is he going to hang around after the funeral, Richard?
Well, I don't think he'll be hanging around long at all. I mean, he may want to spend some time with his grandmother, which he'll be unable to do while he's in quarantine. Mm. But he'll want to get back to Meghan. He'll want to get back to Archie. She's pregnant. They don't like being apart. But quite what the family dynamic is going to be like, we're all fascinated by it. I mean, you can't suddenly sort of paper over the giant cracks that have opened up in this relationship because of what Harry and Meghan said in that Oprah Winfrey interview about the royal family and about family members.
It reminds me, didn't Edward VIII come back for the funeral of his brother George VI, but no Wallis Simpson at the funeral?
That's absolutely right. He came over in 1952 for his brother's funeral, and he regularly came over for funerals, but he was not invited to Queen Elizabeth's coronation in 1953, nor was he invited to her wedding 6 years earlier.
Do you wonder as well whether that rift was never fixed, never sorted? The Queen Mother, of course, we understand, was very opposed to any rapprochement with the Wallis Simpson. Whether that could be the same here? These two brothers were incredibly close, and the fallout has been incredibly deep. And
I think we have perhaps not really worked out just quite how bad it's been. I mean, there is a rift between William and Harry for sure, but there is also a rift between Harry and Kate. I mean, Meghan used that interview to say things about Kate, and indeed even dragged little Princess Charlotte into her endless list of complaints about royal life. Those things are not going to be easily forgiven or forgotten.
Giles Brandreth said, didn't he, in that interesting piece in the Mail this week, Richard, that Prince Philip said, not much good will come of that interview. As ever, wise old thing that he was.
Absolutely. A finger on the button. I mean, he was very dismissive of Prince Charles's interview with Jonathan Dimbleby all those years ago. And he had the same scathing attitude to Princess Diana's Panorama interview. I mean, he was right on both counts, wasn't he? And he will be right. He will be proved right about the Oprah Winfrey.
And just finally, Richard, will we hear directly from Harry, do you think? There will be, because it's all going to go on in the precincts of Windsor Castle. I mean, will the media get a chance to talk to him? Would he talk to us? Is that not a chance in a million years?
I think that's highly unlikely. They won't want to do anything which overshadows the gravity of the occasion, which is paying their respects to a much-loved grandfather.
And 3 o'clock on Saturday?
Yes, it suggests that time suggests to me that there'll be some kind of formal luncheon for all the mourners before they go to the church. Can that happen with COVID rules? I don't know. Perhaps not. Perhaps they will just turn up and go to the service. But it does suggest that there will be some kind of opportunity beforehand.
And we still don't know yet, finally, Richard, who is going to be at that service, only a list of 30. But I think we can probably assume the Sunday Times report that the Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, will be there. More chance of me being there, I'd have thought.
I think, Andrew, you have a better chance. I mean, she was never high on Prince Philip's favourite person's list. I don't know. I mean, 30 seems to be the number. There are all sorts of people you think should be there who haven't been mentioned on any list. You know, the Mountbattens, who are sort of as close as Philip had to a British family, if you like. They, I'm sure, members of their family will be there.
Penny Romsey, who he used to go carriage riding with.
Penny Romsey, of course, his carriage driving companion. Of course, these days is Countess Mountbatten. Yeah. I cannot believe she won't be there.
Very interesting. That's Richard Kay. And you, as you know, with him, he'll always be first with the news on the latest in the funeral of Duke of Edinburgh. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to the Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. They're very good. And remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. With pubs finally reopening, if they've got a garden or an outside space, that is, drinkers and diners are back to having to check into every venue using the NHS app. But are we sleepwalking to a privacy nightmare, with many venue owners now insisting on every drinker and diner checking in rather than just one person from the group? I'm joined now by Ray Walsh, who's digital privacy expert at Pro Privacy. It is a change, isn't it, Ray? Because what they're saying is everyone in a group must check in when they go to a pub or a restaurant. They've either got to use the app or they've got to do some form of scanning. I mean, are you worried about where we're going with all of this?
Exactly, yes. It does seem worrying because, you know, this is the kind of tracking that before the pandemic would have been considered, you know, overly draconian. And so now that it's affecting everybody and not just a party leader, it definitely does raise more concerns because more people are going to be having their, you know, data taken when they do enter. And while it was assumed that, you know, the old app, as we know it, it was assumed that everything was being handled in a decentralized manner, and that, you know, that was okay by everybody. When we first heard about these kind of tracking apps and check-in apps for venues, we were only going to be accepting of them if they could handle data in a private manner that didn't cause the data to be, collected by the government into a centralized repository. And now it would appear that actually they've kind of been attempting to pass an update for the app that would actually cause the data from all these people going to venues to be collected. And the original data protection impact assessment for the app had stated, you know, that one of the reasons that it was safe because people can actually opt out of using it if they want to. And the argument that, you know, we're concerned about now is that, is it really truly optional and is it voluntary if people actually need it to check into venues? Because in actual fact, the only way to actually abstain from using the app is to not enter the venues at all, and that's very limiting.
Do we have to balance up the potential threat to civil liberties with the need to get the economy back open and getting people back to normal? Are people just going to think, I'd rather have a pint than worry about the fact that the government are spying on me all over again?
Yeah, well, the thing is, though, that the app that we had without any updates, with a decentralized approach, that allows people to enter venues and to be to allow tracking to happen in a completely safe way. You know, it's private. It happens on the device. The information is shared from device to device without it going to a central repository. And that system, you know, we already agreed that that was fine. And so people can use that system. The Google and Apple system is very good. And there's absolutely no reason for it to be updated. And the problem is that now Google have blocked the update. So we do now know that even though the government was kind of trying to hoodwink the general public, because the Department of Health had claimed that the update would not affect privacy and that everything was going to carry on as it had been. And in actual fact, we now know that Google are pushing back, Google and Apple are pushing back against the government, because the original agreement for the app, in order for them to be able to use the privacy protecting technology that is used in the app for track and trace, it was agreed that that would not involve collecting the venue checking data to a central repository. And now, the fact that Google's pushing back against the government shows that the government was actually planning to change things in the new update and to actually track everybody's locations. And that is very worrying, because any time that you have a centralized repository of tracking information, you can use that data for investigative purposes, whether that be for the police, and it can be used for secondary purposes further down the line potentially, which is why we don't want that data amassing in a central database.
And there's nothing, I suppose, Ray, just finally, people can do about it, because you can't opt out. So the only way you can opt out is if you choose to stay at home and not go to a pub or a restaurant.
Exactly. Well, one option is just to pretend that you haven't got a phone or whatever. But
I was going to ask you that. What would people say? I mean, I was speaking to somebody the other day. They've got an iPhone 4. Well, it doesn't have any apps on it.
Exactly. And for those people, presumably what they will do is they'll still be asked to leave a telephone number and name at the door. And that raises completely different privacy issues, because in the first lockdown last year, people that were leaving their details at the door, there was a danger that the staff could abuse that data. They could obviously see the data, they could see the name, they could see the telephone number, they could potentially pinch that for their own uses, which happened a few times. Because it is just written on a piece of paper at the door, there's also a potential for other punters to see that data, which could lead to privacy issues. So that's not really a decent solution, because people are only exposing themselves to different issues.
Fascinating, isn't it? What are you going to do about it? If you want to go to the pub and have a pint or go to a restaurant, are you just going to have to stay at home, or will you put a peg on your nose and do what you have to do?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what we hope is that the government now will not roll out any changes to the app which involve the centralized collection of people's location data, because as long as everything continues as it had been, you can actually use the app pretty safely. The only data that is collected is in an aggregated manner, and it's only used, it is worth mentioning that the old app did actually collect data, but it did so in a way that had been de-identified, and that should mean that the government can still get the information it needs. It can still figure out, hotspots where the virus is very prevalent, and it can still provide, the community with information about venues or locations that have been exposed, highly exposed to the virus, and where people might actually run a high risk of contracting the virus. But they can do that without actually collecting people's location data to a centralized repository in such a way that it allows for surveillance. And that's the crux of the problem. We don't want the app to change. We don't want it to start collecting data to a central repository. And as long as it doesn't, people can feel safe using the app.
Very interesting. That's Ray Walsh, who's digital privacy expert at Pro Privacy. Thanks for joining us. So it's that time of the podcast. I'm talking Matter City with our very fine business editor, Ruth Sunderland. Ruth, some people predicted with Brexit that big companies like PricewaterhouseCoopers, Goldman Sachs would scale back, reduce staff, maybe even go elsewhere. Well, Goldman Sachs are moving. They're building new offices in Birmingham and creating hundreds of jobs in the process. Now, that's an interesting move for a blue chip city firm to go to our second city.
It certainly is. And, it's a great thing for Birmingham. They do have a financial services presence there, including outposts of HSBC. And it's a bit of a myth that the financial services sector in this country is confined to the city. That's absolutely not true. There are clusters all around the UK. But we do associate Goldman Sachs with Wall Street and with the City of London. That's certainly true. So this is interesting on a number of levels. I mean, it's interesting in terms of Brexit, because we had heard people saying, that people are going to be setting up in Paris or in Amsterdam and not in the UK. Well, this goes against that. It's also interesting in terms of the pandemic and all of those people who've been saying, well, it's going to all be working from home now, the office is dead. Goldman Sachs totally disagrees with that. Its boss, a guy called David Solomon, said that home working was an aberration recently. He said, you know, doesn't suit the work culture at Goldman Sachs, which is collaborative. It relies on people being together as a team. It relies on apprenticeships and role models and learning from people around you. And this is very much in that spirit. You know, it's 500 people initially and possibly growing into more jobs there, and a great thing, as you say, for Birmingham.
I have nothing but fond memories of Birmingham, Ruth, because I worked for the Birmingham Mail for 2 years. My only worry was, would I be able to understand the accent? But you get used to it.
And did you?
I did get you. I understood it, but I don't think my accent changed. So they'll have a fine time there. That's Ruth Sunderland, who is, of course, the Daily Mail's business editor. The BMI, or to give it its proper full title, the Body Mass Index, is a measurement which has been used for decades by doctors to work out if patients are over or underweight. But is it accurate? A report on body image by MPs on the Women and Equalities Committee has now called for an end to the use of BMI as a measurement of whether an individual's weight is healthy. So are they right? I'm joined now by Daily Mail health writer Pat Hagan. Pat, are they right? And why now?
Why now? Because eating disorders have really come to the forefront during the pandemic. There's genuine concern that that during lockdown, people who are susceptible to eating disorders or eating, you know, abnormal eating patterns, they've had more of a focus. They've had more of a reason to think about their problems. And the charity Beat, which is the main eating disorder charity in the UK, I think has had a threefold increase in calls to its helpline. So what the committee is saying is that BMI isn't helping because BMI focuses, it's essentially a fat score, and it tells you whether you're doing well or not doing well. And at the bottom end of the scale, we find people who display all the behaviors of an eating disorder. So they might have restrictive eating patterns, over-exercising, that kind of thing. They're ticking all the boxes for eating disorder. But when you measure their body mass index, they don't fit the criteria. They're still marginally inside the healthy range, which means they don't qualify for treatment on the NHS. And at the other end of the scale, you have the opposite problem where some people who are very fit, muscly, they go to the gym a lot, they have very little body fat content. But according to the BMI, they qualify as either overweight or even obese, because the index measures your weight compared to your height, but it assumes that if you have a certain score, that it's made up of fat rather than muscle, and that's in some cases it is, in a lot of cases it is, but in some cases, such as very fit, very large rugby players who have very, very low body fat content, it's nonsense.
Do you detect whether the GPs, the medical world, is going to sit up and take notice of this report? Because we've had the BMI with us for so long. And in fact, I had my checkup this year, Pat, just a few weeks ago, and my doctor said, oh, you're spot on with your BMI. And we had a conversation about that. So I felt satisfied. And now, of course, I'm thinking, oh, maybe I shouldn't be quite so happy.
No, so you know it's a very, very useful tool. It's incredibly useful, and nobody is saying. In fact, apart from what the MPs are saying, is that their report is essentially about eating disorders. But I don't think anyone is really saying scrap the BMI in primary care. Don't use it at all. But don't rely on it as a diagnosis of whether someone is overweight or obese or having an eating disorder. It's a part of a jigsaw. It's just one part. So if you take the BMI, I expect, Andrew, you also had your weight measured, you had your cholesterol levels, your blood pressure.
I did.
So it's part of a package. And the doctor wouldn't, and if you had all those and everything else within a healthy range, and your BMI was nudging overweight or getting into the overweight sector, then the doctor would make an assessment based on your lifestyle. If you go to the gym five times a week and you're lifting you know, you're lifting heavy weights, there's a very good chance that you're in the overweight category because you're carrying much more muscle than fat. I mean, I know, you know, that's certainly my excuse for having a high BMI.
Right. Now, some of the MPs, of course, are saying the BMI is an excuse or a justification for weight shaming, which has to stop. But we do have to shame some people, Pat, don't we, into losing weight because we are probably the fattest country in Europe. And that is a factor almost certainly, as we've talked about, in our high death rate or certainly infection rate from COVID-19.
Yeah. Very important, again, I'm going to say this, stress again, that the MP's report is in the context largely of eating disorders, which has a very, which is essentially classed as mental health problems, and mental illnesses. They're not simply, it's not about picky eating. It's a psychological disorder where self-image and body perception is crucial to making a healthy recovery. So in the context of eating disorders, labeling someone with a BMI score probably is quite a sensitive issue. What the problem people have with BMI is that it's a fantastic tool for assessing populations, so large groups of people. So it's used to measure overall trends in UK obesity. The problem arises when you use it at an individual level to say to a patient, you're clinically obese. Let's talk about the rugby players again. So in the article today, we talk about Kyle Sinclair, who's one of the England Rugby Union players. And he, I don't know if you know him, but he's pure muscle, as most of those players are. So his BMI is 37.2. Now, that's only just below the level where he would almost qualify for bariatric surgery for obesity. So there are loopholes in the system, and I think the overall message is that that GPs need to use BMI as a tool, but not the only tool. And actually, the real message from the BMI thing, it can be hard for people who work very hard to stay fit and condition themselves to be constantly told, well, according to the BMI index, you're overweight, when they're clearly not. But the real message is that people who fall into the BMI healthy range, that's not necessarily, a green light for them to do whatever they want. So you could be in the BMI healthy range, but let's say you're very tall and you're carrying fat around your waistline. You've got a pot belly.
Not good.
And not good. You don't do any exercise. Your diet is appalling. And what that means is that the fat, you've got high fat content, and it's gathering around your vital organs. So it's called visceral fat. It's very, very damaging. And that's why some people are saying that waist circumference is actually a much more accurate indicator of likely health problems than BMI.
Fascinating. That's the Mel's health writer, Pat Hagan. Pat, that's really interesting. Thank you for that. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I am Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.